And that's Hayworth versus City of Walla Walla. And this case is set for 15 minutes per side. And for the appellant, we have George Aprend. If I mispronounce the name, I apologize for that.
It's Aaron, Your Honor.
For the appellees, we've got Richard Brooks and Heather Yackley.
Yackley, thank you, Your Honor.
Heather Yackley.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm sorry, my middle name is Brooks. My last name is Jolly. Thank you.
Oh. Okay, so, well, Mr. Jolly. Okay, thank you. So the, without further ado, we can get started. If the appellant wants to make a rebuttal argument, the best thing to do is to save some of your time and don't use it all up. But if any advocate gets in trouble on time and needs extra time, you can ask me and I'll do my best to help you out. So without further ado, why don't we start with the appellant's argument?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is George Arend. I'd like to reserve, or I will endeavor to reserve, 6 minutes of my time for rebuttal. On behalf of Mr. Hayworth, we're asking the court to reverse the summary judgment of dismissal entered against all defendants, or the motion to dismiss entered against all defendants, and remand this case for discovery and trial on the merits. I'd like to begin, at the risk of not being interesting, I'd like to begin with what I think is the least interesting, but also the simplest issue to resolve in this case, and that's malicious prosecution. The district court dismissed the state law malicious prosecution claims against all defendants on grounds that there was probable cause for this prosecution. And underlying the court's decision was the legal assumption that probable cause is satisfied if it is present at the inception of the lawsuit. But we know from state law, and we've cited the Banks versus Nordstrom case, that probable cause, anytime it evaporates during the course of a prosecution, can give rise to a malicious prosecution claim. And this claim was dismissed with prejudice precisely because there was a lack of probable cause after a review by an independent prosecutor who concluded there was a lack of probable cause. And so what do the appellees come forward with is, at various times, the state court ruled in response to motions to dismiss that there was probable cause.
Counsel, did the special prosecutor say that the special prosecutor specifically found a lack of probable cause? Did the special prosecutor use those words?
He did not use that precise words.
So he didn't use the words probable cause.
Correct. At ER 377, you have his exact words, which I think are tantamount to a finding of an absence of probable cause.
Counsel, did AS ever withdraw her allegation? Did AS ever say, no, your client didn't rape me? Was there anything that she ever said to the prosecutors that would have led them to believe that she had retracted her allegation?
I don't believe we have evidence of a retraction. We didn't get to do discovery, but on this record, we don't have evidence of a retraction. What we do know is under state law. Yes, Your Honor.
No, I want you to finish your answer and then I have a question.
Under state law, the dismissal of a case is prima facie evidence of a lack of probable cause. And then you throw in what the prosecutor found and the language of the dismissal order and the other evidence in the case, you at a minimum have a question of fact about probable cause. That completes my answer.
My question is, at what point, you're saying there no longer existed probable cause, but the prosecution continued. At what point do you contend that was?
It was at a point before the termination of litigation. The record doesn't identify a specific date. I can say with some confidence it didn't evaporate precisely on the day that the case was dismissed. with everything that you've got in front of you in this record, it evaporated at some point before the termination of the litigation. But a precise date I can't give you in the record doesn't reflect.
Do you think that discovery, you were had been allowed to pursue discovery, that you would have been able to figure out that date or pinpoint that date?
Absolutely. I think we would be obligated to, and that's what a lot of the discovery on this claim, that would be one of the things that we would be endeavoring to establish.
Mr. Arend, if I could interject a question, please.
Of course.
Is it the law that if there's a dismissal of the suit, that then creates a presumption that there was no probable cause?
Not in the sense of a conclusive presumption. What the case law says, and Banks' case says this, is it is prima facie evidence of a lack of probable cause. It can create a question of fact regarding the existence of probable cause.
Okay, so that would be basically in substance a rebuttable presumption, right? It could be rebutted by evidence, but absent the evidence, there's an issue of fact.
Yes, and it would be rebutted by presentation of different, you know, plaintiff and opposing cases in front of a jury. And it would be up to the jury to conclude whether it's been rebutted, unless no reasonable juror could conclude that there's an absence of probable cause. And I submit that you can't do that on this record, especially in light of, like I said, what the independent prosecutor found, as well as the other evidence that was produced in the case. So at a minimum, we think that we need a remand on the malicious prosecution claim. Because we have to choose what issues to focus on in the relatively
I have one more question on malicious prosecution. You agree that the test in Washington State for probable cause is reasonable ground for suspicion. Is that right? It's certainly less than beyond a reasonable doubt. And you don't weigh conflicting evidence in deciding probable cause in Washington State courts, correct?
It is, I don't believe suspicion. It's reasonable grounds to believe a crime has been committed, is my understanding.
Okay, reasonable grounds to believe a crime has been committed, and you don't weigh conflicting evidence in the Washington state courts. You don't get into credibility determinations with regard to probable cause. Is that right?
Correct. I think it's more of an issue of like a 12B6 kind of posture. You accept you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution on that. So, I think we've got enough to go to the jury on that issue. I'd like to talk next about the search warrant affidavit compiled at the direction and vouched for, essentially. I think it's a vouching by Deputy Prosecutor Morales. This was a redo of a suppressed fruits of a invalid pre-charge investigative search warrant. And Deputy Prosecutor Morales, pursuant to, and this was reviewed by the prosecutor, Mr. Nagel, pursuant to what appears to be a practice and policy within the Walla Walla Prosecutor's department, redid an investigative warrant to try and overcome the grounds for suppressing it in the first place. And in doing so, she did a couple things. One, she artificially constrained what the officer was allowed to consider, who was attesting to the facts in the search warrant affidavit, to exclude everything that had been discovered in the year and 3 months between the time that the original investigative search warrant was done and when it was redone. And then not only did it cabin the information that was subject to consideration, it also included false statements. The most important false statements, there are several about the location of the evidence and the residence of the accused and things like that. But the big one is, it says this search warrant is because we have probable cause to believe that it will reveal pictures and videos taken by the accused, Mr. Hayworth, in this case. At the time that search warrant was filled out, Deputy Prosecutor Morales signed an affidavit saying she reviewed it. According to her deposition testimony, she said she knew that statement was false, because the products of the original search warrant, which were in a police locker still, evidence locker, the products revealed no pictures taken by the defendant, no videos taken by Mr. Hayworth. She knew that was false. She also knew that the officer who filled out the search warrant affidavit had no idea that was false. She also knew, as she attested in her deposition testimony, that the judge who reviewed the search warrant, the redone search warrant application, had no knowledge or information that was false. And yet she certified that she reviewed the search warrant affidavit and never disclosed this falsehood. Now, she also never disclosed all the stuff that happened in the intervening 1 year and 3 months that would call into question whether the search warrant would be issued, whether there would be limitations on the scope or manner of the search warrant, or things of that nature as well. The district court below held that was absolutely immune under prosecutorial immunity because it was done after charges were filed. But we know from this court's precedent, we've cited them in the briefing, charging is not a bright line between a prosecutorial function and an investigative function. We also know that according to the Supreme Court and this court's precedent, we look at prosecutorial immunity from a functional perspective, not from a title perspective or a timing perspective. And this was an investigative search warrant that was being redone. The fact that it happened to be redone after charges was filed doesn't turn it into something that's absolutely prosecutorially immune. And then, of course, there's the qualified immunity question. And it just can't be the case that a knowingly incomplete, rendering it false because it omits all the exculpatory information in the intervening year and 3 months, a knowingly false because it identified a number of facts that were wrong, notably the fact that the search warrant was based on the belief that there was probable cause of finding pictures and images taken by the accused, that can't satisfy qualified immunity. And that's why Deputy Prosecutor Morales is subject to liability, still have to prove the claim, but gets past immunity. That's why Mr. Nagel, the prosecutor, he ratified it. He reviewed it according to his testimony, and that this was done according to the standard operating procedure within the Walla Walla Prosecutor's Office, and that is why the county is liable as well. I'd like to reserve, if I may, the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the next one, we're now going to hear from the appellees, and the appellees' 15 minutes is divided into 7.5 minutes for Mr. Jolly and 7.5 minutes for Ms. Yakeley. Is that pronounced right? Okay, so...
it is. Sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
Who's going to step up with the first part of the argument?
Your Honor, that would be me, Richard Jolly, on behalf.
And let me just ask the clerk to set the time for these advocates separately. So set 7.5 minutes, and now we can start with Mr. Jolly.
Good morning. May it please the court, Richard Jolly, on behalf of Detective Marcus Goodwater, Walla Walla Police Chief. Oh, I'm sorry. Can the court hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I can hear you.
Yeah. And also on behalf of Police Chief Scott Bieber and the city of Walla Walla, I'll begin by addressing plaintiff's arguments, or excuse me, appellant's arguments related to the malicious prosecution claim. As Judge Bennett inquired, there is nothing in the dismissal language or the letter from the independent prosecutor that stated, I'm dismissing this case because there's lack of probable cause. In fact, what the prosecutor noted is that he had questions as to whether the case could actually be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. And clearly, if they can't prove it beyond...
The sentence that we're all talking about says, the court finds insufficient evidence exists in this case to support criminal charges and or sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's susceptible of either meaning, especially since there's a slash in there. Is that something that needs to go to the jury?
No, Your Honor. I would submit first that because the prosecutor also references that has doubts as to whether it can be proved by a preponderance, which is a higher standard than probable cause. As the district court pointed out in its summary judgment order, probable cause is a lower threshold. And so that would be reason one why this doesn't go to a jury, or why discovery doesn't need to be reopened. But additionally, the district court's ruling staying discovery, that's reviewed for an abuse of discretion, if I'm not mistaken. And the district court, as it pointed out in its summary judgment order, when granting the stay of discovery to rule on the qualified immunity motions, the court invited appellant to actually point out what could be gleaned from discovery that would change arguments or would change issues of law. And that was something that was not provided by appellant, even though the court specifically invited appellant to do so. And Your Honor, I believe in the questioning of appellant's counsel, you inquired as to what changed during the course of the prosecution. And the fact that the victim never recanted, and the fact that the statute in Washington allows a sexual assault claim to go forward just based on the testimony of the victim, I think that's significant. But there was other evidence supporting the prosecution other than simply the testimony of the victim. There were likewise the graphic sexual photos that were found on a hard drive or a related to Mr. Hallworth's phone. Now that we understand that they had an expert that was disputing how the photos got there, but it doesn't change that that was also something for the criminal court to consider.
They were not disputing that the photos were of AS or that it was Mr. Hallworth's phone. They disputed how it got there. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And then likewise, there was also the what the detectives and the prosecutor characterized as a peephole into the complaining witness's bedroom. So there, none of those facts ever changed throughout the prosecution. So even if there are arguments that, well, the victim's credibility was impacted, we would submit to the court that there was sufficient evidence to meet the probable cause threshold throughout. And the fact that the appellant did not take the court's invitation to actually submit what they intended to uncover in the course of discovery that would change issues of law related to probable cause, related to qualified immunity, that's an abuse of discretion standard. And the appellants have not even now presented anything other than vague generalities about what they think discovery would uncover that would change the issues of law that were ruled on by the district court. Because counsel for the prosecutor's office and for the county is going to address things related to prosecutorial immunity, I'll just jump in real quick on the due process claims related to destruction of evidence. One of the allegations is that Detective Goodwater directed the complaining witness to delete an internet comment, and conspicuously absent from the briefing from appellee or from appellant is the content of that actual comment that was linked to a newspaper article. And the comment was, he did it, or words to those effect, which on its face doesn't seem to be exculpatory in nature. If it had any evidentiary value, we would submit to the court that that was inculpatory. Likewise, regarding Detective Goodwater's failure to document the interview with the grandmother. As the court is aware, to make out a substantive due process claim, there has to be a finding of bad faith, and likewise, there has to be a showing that the criminal defendant was somehow harmed. We would submit first that Detective Goodwater didn't actually suppress anything related to the interview of the grandmother. He readily admitted that happened. When the grandmother pointed that out to the prosecutor, Detective Goodwater quickly wrote a supplemental report. The criminal defendant, now the appellant, counsel had opportunity twice to interview the grandmother. And related to the good faith standard, we would submit that there was little evidentiary value to the grandmother's opinions. She opined first off that the mother was a pathological liar, and then likewise that the victim was similar. And we would submit that Detective Goodwater was acting in good faith, and that there is no substantive due process claim as a matter of law. And am I reading the clock wrong? Am I out of time?
14 seconds over time, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, would you mind if counsel just addressed the third prong of the issues related to Officer Goodwater, which is the interference with Michael Tarascano's exonerating testimony?
Yeah, please go ahead. Go ahead, counsel.
Yes, I'd be glad to. As the district court pointed out, there was nothing about Detective Goodwater's interaction with Michael Tarascano that appeared to impact Mr. Hallworth. The allegation is that Detective Goodwater was attempting to intimidate Michael Tarascano because he indicated that he could be prosecuted under the circumstances based on the information that was being offered by the criminal defense team. And the court will recall that the allegations here were that the complaining witness, that she was intoxicated, she passed out, and she woke up to find someone that she believed was Tony Hallworth having sex with her. And so if she's passed out, then she obviously cannot consent to sex. And so that was what Detective Goodwater was referencing, not when he spoke to Michael Tarascano, but to his father. But we would submit to the court that that had no impact on the criminal defense team's ability to defend Mr. Hallworth, because there's no allegation that Michael Tarascano said, you know, I'm not going to testify at trial, I'm not going to be interviewed, I'm not going to participate in any way. In fact, he was interviewed twice. So we would submit to the court that the interaction between Detective Goodwater and not Michael Tarascano, but Michael Torrescano's father, which was all of a 3-minute telephone call, that doesn't give rise to a due process claim for Mr. Hallworth.
Counsel, could I interject a question, please? So my understanding is that the case was dismissed because of the independent prosecutor's views before trial. So the case never went to trial. And so it doesn't seem possible that the element of interference could be shown, that the interference caused a witness not to testify at trial if there was no trial. So am I missing something there?
No, Your Honor, but we would submit that when you look at the series of cases dealing with intimidation of witnesses, it appears to arise most frequently in the context of a prosecutor warning a witness before they take the stand that if you tell this story and you help out the criminal defendant, that you are going to be prosecuted for perjury. And here, all we're talking about is a very brief telephone call where Detective Hallworth relayed to the father that Michael could be charged with a crime based on what the criminal defense team was submitting, which is that if the reporting or complaining witness was intoxicated and she wakes up to find someone having sex with her, that that person was in fact Michael Toroscano and not Tony Hallworth. So we would submit that the factual circumstances here, that it doesn't require additional discovery, that as a matter of law, the court could conclude that Detective Goodwater was acting in good faith. And we understand that the case was not decided, the summary judgment motion was not decided on collateral estoppel. But as the district court pointed out, the fact that the trial judge in the criminal case evaluated these issues repeatedly based on multiple motions for governmental misconduct, and the court repeatedly found that what Detective Goodwater had done did not give rise to any sort of government misconduct. That's not a collateral estoppel argument, but it certainly shows that Detective Goodwater could have believed that his conduct was lawful, including interaction with Michael Toroscano, the witness's father, because he wasn't being threatened with perjury. It was just a matter of fact statement.
Mr. Jolly, you're now about 5 minutes over your time, so I want you to answer fully if Judge Wardlaw feels her question was not answered.
No, my question was answered. Thank you.
Okay.
So, thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Jolly, we thank you for your argument. I think we should turn to Ms. Yakeley for Walla Walla County.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, Heather Yakeley here on behalf of the Walla Walla County prosecutors who are individually named, Michelle Morales and Jim Nagel. Michelle Morales is the deputy prosecuting attorney who was prosecuting this case. Jim Nagel was the, is the elected prosecutor for Walla Walla County. I will also spend just a couple minutes talking about the malicious prosecution questions that were raised. Mr. Jolly is correct that I have a slightly different situation because my clients are prosecuting attorneys and therefore from their perspective are entitled to absolute immunity. So I want to take just 1 minute. Judge Wardlaw read the language. It's insufficient evidence to support criminal charges and or sustain beyond a reasonable doubt. We all know and we've discussed that this was an independent prosecutor, but I don't think that what I'll refer to as kind of the tortured history of how that all went to the independent prosecutor should be brushed aside. And that is, this was at Franklin County first. The prosecutor deemed that he had a conflict and referred it out to Walla Walla County because of a variety of motions to continue, etc. This case, the criminal trial kept getting pushed back. And when it was ultimately supposed to go to trial, Ms. Morales was essentially 8.5 months pregnant. And it was a given that she could very well have delivered during this trial. So a request for continuance was requested that was denied. And so because of the situation at the Walla Walla County Prosecutor's Office, the case was then sent back. Walla Walla County had to withdraw, and it was sent back to Franklin County. So what we have is we have a whole series of lawyers looking at this case, and we also have a whole series of, two judges looking at this case no less than 5 times in terms of probable cause. And so what the appellant is arguing essentially is you should be putting more weight on this independent prosecutor's review than any of the judges or any of the other individuals involved. And there's simply no legal basis for that.
Is that a question for us or is it a question for the jury? I don't think the fact that Ms. Morales was pregnant is in the record we have. So I don't know if we can consider those extenuating circumstances as much as I'm sympathetic, but.
And fair enough. Walla Walla County withdrew. I do believe that's in the record that Walla Walla County withdrew.
Right.
My apologies.
And then it went to an independent prosecutor. That's in the record.
At least as to, and I mean, no disrespect or attempt to throw Mr. Jolly and his clients under the proverbial bus, but at least with respect to my clients, no, it's not a question of fact for the jury because the cases are clear. And in fact, even in a case cited by the appellant at Botello versus Gamick, that's 413 Fed Third 971 at 976, the cases and the cases in this circuit have been very clear that the decision to prosecute or not prosecute is absolutely entitled to absolute immunity. So at least with respect to the prosecuting attorneys, there's nothing to strip them from the absolute immunity in this case that's in the record with respect to malicious prosecution. So I don't believe that it's a question of fact for the jury, at least as to my clients, Your Honor. Barring any further questions on the malicious prosecution, I want to just spend my remaining time to discuss the Michelle Morales Declaration, or what's been referred to as the Michelle Morales Declaration. The appellant has argued inserted herself in the investigatory process. That's absolutely not correct. And you can look at the plain language of the documents. Her declaration that's in question is ER 261 through 262. And when you look at that, there's literally nothing in that declaration other than setting forth to the trial court, the criminal trial court, why they're doing what they're doing, which is having Detective Loney do another affidavit. And while I believe that's sufficient to entitle Ms. Morales to absolute immunity, because in fact, it's wholly tied to the actual litigation of the trial. So in other words, the cases are also very clear in the circuit that if you are trying to keep evidence in, actions taken by a prosecutor are entitled to absolute immunity. This was not an administrative declaration. This was not a declaration where she is inserting herself into the investigation. In fact, you could take Mr. Aaron's argument a few moments ago where he says there's untrue statements in Loney's affidavit, and you can use that and say, okay, but if in fact there are untrue statements in there, then it's obvious that Ms. Morales did not insert herself into that underlying search warrant. All of that notwithstanding, Ms. Morales is absolutely entitled to qualified immunity if this panel believes that she is not for some reason entitled to the absolute immunity, because State versus McKee was a brand new case. This search warrant was issued in April of 2017. The case State versus McKee, which was the issue of particularity, was published in March of 2018. Obviously, it's a brand new case. It's brand new law. Ms. Morales acts, quite frankly, appropriately to determine what she's supposed to do. And whether or not her declaration and the supporting and Detective Loney's declaration were not the correct solution, that's precisely why qualified immunity exists. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Malicious prosecution. There is no case that says you have to have a recantation by the complaining witness in order to establish a lack of probable cause. Probable cause is a question of fact. There are sufficient questions of fact. We have the prima facie case, according to Banks versus Nordstrom, because
do you have any case from any jurisdiction that says that in a personal injury type of criminal case, that an unrecanted statement from a victim that this defendant who I know well, as opposed to some stranger, this person who I know well assaulted or raped me, that that is not, as a matter of law, probable cause in either Washington State or any other jurisdiction? Any case that says that?
I haven't cited one. You make me think of a Westlaw search that I could do after this proceeding. But, you know, it is equally true that there's no case establishing the opposite proposition. What we do have is that probable cause is a question of fact. And we have, you know, this is a witness where we've got people who know, friends, family, grandma, say this person is a pathological liar, untrustworthy, and has a motive to lie. And before this ever surfaced, hatched a plan to destroy Mr. Hayworth. You don't need a recantation. You shouldn't need a recantation to go to a jury under those facts.
Counsel, let me interject a question for a moment. Assuming that Ms. Yakeley's correct, that the prosecutors should have absolute immunity or qualified immunity on your claims of lack of probable cause, who are the defendants who you could proceed against in the case?
The city of Walla Walla, if they have absolute immunity, the city of Walla Walla and the Detective Goodwater, Chief Bieber, and the county of Walla Walla.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. On to Deputy Prosecutor Morales' declaration. She testifies in her declaration that she told the officer what to consider. That's in paragraph 6 on ER 262. Then she says, I reviewed the affidavit. McKee was a new decision, but there's nothing in McKee that says when you're redoing a defective search warrant that's been suppressed, that you exclude exculpatory evidence or evidence bearing on the credibility of the complaining witness. There's nothing in McKee that says you submit a redone search warrant affidavit that contains absolutely false information that goes to the heart of the affidavit, right? That affidavit was saying we have probable cause to believe that defendant Hayworth took pictures and videos of the defendant. We know that that's not true. And of course, we're starting to argue about the facts when we listen to the arguments, and I think that's been pointed out. But, you know, talk about these photographs that show up on a phone. There was a backup to a family iCloud account, which is how they got there. If that is an issue today, that's an issue that should go to the jury. They don't have any contrary evidence. And now they admit, of course, that the pictures weren't taken by Mr. Hayworth. They don't have any contrary evidence. If that is a fact, if that is important today, that issue has to go to the jury along with the rest of these issues. Lastly,
Counsel, are you saying that Ms. Morales knew at the time of the second affidavit that the pictures were from the iCloud and were not taken by Haywater or Hayworth?
I don't have directly that proposition. I have an adjacent proposition, which is she knew that he didn't take the photos. And that's on ER 176. And that the officer who swore the affidavit and the judge who reviewed the affidavit didn't know that Mr. Hayworth had not taken the photos. About the iCloud stuff, that we never got that far in this record in order to establish that.
So they knew that Mr. Hayworth hadn't taken the photos, but they didn't know who had and how they ended up on his phone.
They knew who had. They were all selfies, but one that was taken by a boyfriend. They knew that. That's in the record.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a record citation for iCloud. I think it may be in there, but I might have to follow up with that.
All right.
The last thing is probable cause. This was scrutinized by judges on, I think Ms. Yakeley said, on 5 different occasions. Of course, we were never aggrieved because we got the charges dismissed. So we never got to appeal those decisions. And they want a backdoor collateral estoppel. If anything, Mr. Hayworth should be entitled to the benefit. Oh, I see I've gone over. I I misread my clock. May I briefly conclude?
Please do.
Yes, I don't hear.
Yes, I had asked you a question and got you off track. I apologize.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. So I want to say, though, if anything, we should be entitled to the collateral estoppel of the dismissal with prejudice, unusual in a criminal case like this, and certainly entitled to evidentiary, if not collateral estoppel effect. For those reasons, we'd ask the court to reverse and remand for discovery and trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ann. But this is a very challenging and interesting case. I want to thank Mr. Arend, Mr. Jolly, Ms. Yakeley, for their excellent advocacy, because you've all presented your clients' views very nicely. At this point, the case of Hayworth versus City of Walla Walla shall be submitted, and the parties will hear from the panel in due course. Thank you. That concludes our argument calendar for day, but I do have to mention additional cases that are submitted on the briefs. So the next case on our docket is Purnell v. Kijakazi. It's a Social Security case, 21-3-5619. That case is submitted on the briefs. The next case after that is Liebert versus Commissioner of Social Security, number 21-35435, and that's submitted on briefs. The next case after that is Cruz Briones versus Garland. That's number 16-70610. That's submitted on briefs. The next case is Fangsrud von Esch and René Fangsrud von Esch versus Asset Systems, number 21-35217. That case is submitted on briefs. The next case is Donna Flexner versus Kijakazi, number 21-35346. That case is submitted on briefs. And then finally, we have Silva versus Buttigieg, number 21-35694. That is submitted on the briefs. And so with that, that concludes our docket for today, and the court is going to adjourn for the week unless there's some other comment that Judge Wardlaw or Judge Bennett wish to make. Okay, hearing none, the court will adjourn, and thank counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.